on today's 21st.
Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned.
Oh.
It is just a complete nightmare.
That's Judge Rosemary Aquilina reading a letter written by Dr. Larry Nassar, the U.S. team gymnastics doctor who was sentenced to 175 years in prison for abusing more than 150 young women during his time as a trainer. Today, we're talking about the fallout from this case on Michigan State University, where Nassar worked for almost two decades. But first, the story of one Illinois man, an undocumented immigrant.
You know, I think there's an experience that's particular to all immigrants everywhere in the world. Like, once you leave home, you can never go back. You know, you can never reach home or return home. You're always caught in the middle.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. We'll get started just after the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. What does it mean to live among the shadows, to be an undocumented immigrant in the United States? Jose Angel N. left Guadalajara as a teenager, and for almost the past 25 years, he's lived in the U.S., mostly in the Chicago area. He's written about his life in a memoir. It's called Illegal, Reflections of an Undocumented Immigrant. It's a haunting account of his life in the United States, and the book has been adopted as a reading requirement for numerous Latino study courses across the country. For those of you in the Champaign-Urbana area, he's actually speaking this evening at the University of Illinois, and he's in studio with me now. And I should note, Jose Angel's last name isn't listed on the book. We're not going to say it as well due to his undocumented status. Jose Angel, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you for having me.
Why did you write this book?
Well, that is a very complicated question, but I think this is a very good moment to reflect on that, actually, because when I wrote this book, I thought that many people were talking about the issue of undocumented immigration at the time, and the people who were actually affected by, you know, undocumented immigration were not being heard. You know, and I'm saying that because, you know, with the current debate on immigration, we're not talking about more than 10 million people. I mean, we're talking about DACA recipients and, you know, the debate about the border and chain migration and the lottery. But we're not talking about people like me, like 10 million or more people. Nobody has talked about it, not the Democrats or the Republicans. And back then, when I wrote this book, I wanted to, you know, to tell people that we're not invisible. You know, we're human beings who live among you.
We're going to talk about the changes since you wrote the book and now in a few minutes. But I want to first just understand a little bit of your story. You came here when you were about 19. Why did you decide to come across the border?
Right. I think the place where I come from, you know, from a socially disadvantaged background, a place like that, you know, that's usually expected of you, that you will either go north or take a job where you're barely going to make ends meet every week. And, you know, I took my chances going north because that's actually a rite of passage for many of us. You know, that's how you become a man many times back where I come from. So that was sort of expected of me, and, you know, that's what I did.
And so you started working when you were a child. Your first job was when you were what? Like, you write about this in the book, when you were like 6 or 7?
Yeah. I think I was very young. I was probably, like 7. So my one of the things that one of my uncles did was distribute on a tray, you know, in our neighborhoods. They went to a bakery, and you will go to a bakery, and they will give you a whole tray of all pan dulce, that's what we call it, you know, the pastries. And you will go around the houses in the neighborhood selling them or, you know, delivering them. And that's, you know, that was my first job. I went along with them, and, you know, I understood that was something that I needed to do in order to pitch in to my, you know, to the expenses in my family.
And so you write about the memory of how much that was a ritual for you, even as an adult, a way for you to sort of hold on to your memories as a child. Do you still have pan con dulce and coffee in the morning?
I try every time I get a chance. Unfortunately, it's not always there, but I wish I had it all the time. I love that. That's a good way to keep memory alive.
So you ended up paying about $2,000, was it, for your family paid, I imagine, to hire the coyote who smuggled you. How do you know how many jobs you had to work to pay that back? How long did it take you to pay that money back?
Well, I think it probably took me about, 2 years or so, you know, because, when I came to Chicago, I came with the idea that I was going to do whatever it took in order for me to pay, right? And in order for me to be able to save a little money and send it back home, or send money and then keep a little bit and save it and still pay for my own expenses. So it took probably like 2 years in order for me to pay that. It wasn't easy.
How did you end up in Chicago?
I do have relatives in Chicago who had been here for 20 years. You know, I mean, that's the Chicago has an interesting history, Illinois in general. Chicago has an interesting history with Mexican migration. We've been coming to this state for about 100 years.
I was going to say, a very long time.
Yeah, for about 100 years, we've been coming here, you know, right after the Mexican Revolution. And in Chicago, particularly in the area of Pilsen, for instance, you know, that's where the Mexican community was established, you know, at the turn of the 1960s or something like that. But there are so many different areas in Chicago as well, in the south suburbs and, you know, the west suburbs of Chicago, where there's a lot of, there's a really big Mexican population.
So you were a translator, so of course you learned English when you came here. And you wrote that this put you at odds a little bit with many members of your family that were asking you oftentimes, why are you learning English? Why are you going to college? Why are you doing all of this? Why was that so important to you, first of all?
I think for me it was important when I first came to the U.S. to be able to communicate, to have a conversation with people, because, you know, I was witness to many instances when I being out with some of my relatives, they had to rely on their children to be able to communicate basic things, you know, for them. And I did not want that to happen to me. I said, this is not going to happen to me. I need to learn English. I need to learn how to rely on myself. You know, I can't just rely on someone else, especially on a child. So this is not going to happen to me. And I made it a point that I was going to learn English, and that got people a little upset with me, because at the time I was working at a factory. They had found a factory job for me on the first shift, which was highly coveted by people.
What time is the first shift?
It's very early, like 6 or
in
7.
In the morning.
Okay. Yes. So I worked there for about 2 weeks or three, and then, you know, at the same time, I was thinking about how I was going to learn English. Everybody at the factory, most people at the factory also spoke Spanish. So you didn't need
to learn English.
Well, that would have been the problem. I didn't need to learn English, but I wanted to. So I started inquiring around, and I found out that I could attend, you know, a place where ESL classes were given. So what I decided, and which upset some people around me, was to quit the factory job, which was, you know, what I came here to do. And what happened was that I left the job and I went on to wash dishes instead, because I will free my mornings.
But that paid less, I imagine.
That paid less.
And probably a lot less stability than a factory job.
It was always there. I mean, I was never out of a job. I worked at a restaurant for about 10 years. And, you know, I worked all the time and I put a lot of extra overtime. So
why do you think they were upset? I think this is do you think it was because you were doing something different?
I think it might have been that I was doing something different. And I come from a very conservative kind of background. And also the fact that, you know, they had the idea that I came here to work, that all of us had come here to work. And to them, learning English was a little bit of a luxury, I think. So remember, I mean, the place where I come from, most people have only had a chance to go to grammar school. And I was lucky enough to do a couple more years of schooling. And for them, that was enough. For many people, it was enough. Even when I was at the restaurant, some of the cooks will tell me, why do you keep going to school? All, you know, the English that you need here is very basic. Like, yes, but it's not all I want. I want to be able to do more than this.
My guest is Jose Angel. He's the author of Illegal Reflections of an Undocumented Immigrant. And as you're sharing this story, you went from learning English to becoming a philosophy major, and we'll get to that in a minute. But I want to ask you about, so you were around 20 when you really started, learning English. How hard was that? It took years, and I wanted to just ask you about that process.
Yes. So first it was learning English, right? That took about 2 years or so to complete. That was full time. I was going full time. So, and what happened was that after that, you know, during my 2 years at ESL classes, one of the teachers told me that, so do you have high school? Like, I'm not sure. What is that? Like, well, you know, this is what you do. You go to school, you have high school. I'm like, you know, I had to find out what the equivalent of that was back in Mexico. So they told me it is preparatoria. I'm like, no, I didn't get a chance to go to preparatoria. And what happened was that she told me, well, you can do that if you want. You can definitely do that. And all you have to do is take this book and come and take some classes here, some GED classes. And then, you know, you'll be good. And when I asked some people around me, I'm like, what is this GED? They told me, well, you go, you do a test, you get a diploma, and then you're going to be able to have this wonderful job. So I did that. And yeah, I thought it was going to be easy, and it wasn't. It wasn't.
Because the test was in English.
It was in English, and I failed it. I took it, failed it, took it again, failed it again, until my third time.
And so you take the test. You took three times to try, but you did it, and then you decided to get your associate's degree. Why did you keep there? You write about this, that at a certain point I imagine this is part of your ambivalence of being in the U.S. and not being here legally and all of the complicated feelings that engenders. One thing that you realized was that books and that learning was in some ways an escape for you. Would that be right?
That's right. It's a little more complicated than that, too, because I didn't come here with the ambition of going to college. That was never on my radar. I mean, that's not what I came here to do. I came here to do whatever it took in order for me to make it, you know, just to survive. You know, if that meant getting down on my knees and scrubbing your toilets, that's what I was going to do. And I didn't start writing until very late in life when I started college, actually. But it wasn't immediately after learning English and getting my GED that I started college. You know, some years went by without me going to school. I didn't start college until I was like 27. By the time, you know, many people have already graduated.
Because you were working.
I was
multiple
working.
Jobs.
And I didn't know that I could attend college either. And I wasn't thinking about it. It was not something that I wanted to do. I mean, it was never something that I thought about, because that's not what people do from my background.
I'm a philosophy major too.
Awesome. I love philosophy.
Why did you choose to major in philosophy?
Oh, well, what happened was that once I
was gonna say, it's not a great career path. There are a lot of people in public radio who are philosophers. It's the only place in journalism I found people who were philosophy majors also.
Yeah. Unless you go on and do a PhD, there's very little you can do with it. But, you know, it gives you a lot of material to think about. Yeah, that's, I mean, that when I first started, what happened was that I picked it. You know, they give you all this list of classes that you can take. You can choose from them. And one of them said philosophy. I'm like, I wonder what that is. So I went to the first class. And, you know, the teacher started talking about Plato and the cave and how people are chained in the cave. I'm like, that sounds so much like me. I mean, I can't believe that people are actually get paid to talk about this, and people write books about, you know, things that that I can like have to go through, but other people only have to imagine and write about. So I was very intrigued by that idea, and so that's you know, that's how I became, like, you know, passionate about philosophy in the beginning. And I decided, since I didn't have any guidance to begin with when I went to college, I'm like, okay, so philosophy might be as good as anything else, because, you know, since nobody in my family had ever gone to college, nobody expected anything from me.
Do you regret not choosing something more practical, like accounting or something like that?
I do write about that in the book, but that's only, you know, I'm being ironic about it. I mean, I will not have chosen anything else other than philosophy, you know, because it has given me these very critical tools that I didn't have before and which have become very helpful to me.
We're going to continue this conversation in just a minute with Jose Angel. He's the author of Illegal Reflections of an Undocumented Immigrant. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Jose Angel N. He's the author of Illegal Reflections of an Undocumented Immigrant. Jose Angel, you decided to study philosophy. You end up becoming a translator. And you wrote something that stuck with me. You said that by becoming a professional, you also became a much sadder man. Can you explain that?
Yes. What I was trying to say was that by becoming a professional, what happened to me was that here I am, right, going into the middle class of America, right, having a professional job, sitting in an office, you know, having vacations paid and whatnot, was putting me really into a circle of people that I didn't belong, where I didn't belong, you know. I had never been in this kind of environment before, and whereas before that I had lived in the south side of Chicago, now I was living on the north side of Chicago. So I was removed physically, emotionally, and socially from the place where I had been living all of my life, you know. So on top of that, by being undocumented, I could not relate to most of the things that they did. You know, people will talk, well, in the summer we're going to go to London and France and we're going to do this and that. And in winter, we may just go for a weekend to Mexico. You know, we're going to go to Cancun or Puerto Vallarta. And
you couldn't travel, obviously.
I couldn't travel. But, you know, I was sitting at the same table as them, you know, and they will ask me questions. And
And they didn't know, to be clear, they didn't know about your status.
No, they did not know. So, you know, I became, you know, I felt this feeling of oppression by not being able to share with anybody what I was going through at the moment. Yes, I was achieving some sort of solvency, economic solvency. But at the same time, you know, I felt this that I could not communicate with people, you know, and it was very isolating for me too. That's when I started to think about writing a book like this, that, you know, what it meant to kind of go on to achieve things that you didn't even think of before, but at the same time, you know, disappearing because you don't really exist in a way that other people do.
And you're writing this during the time of the
2008. Yeah, well,
so you're writing it during the time of the 2008 election because it's Barack Obama's first election. And you write about the fact that your coworkers are going to vote. People are asking everybody's talking about who they're going to vote for. And that's even a really awkward conversation.
Yeah.
Because you don't want to lie to people.
Right. And, you know, I did was put up my headphones, so I wasn't listening. I wasn't related to anybody. I became really good at being, you know, a guy who didn't speak a lot to people. Like, during lunch, everybody will sit at the same table, and I will simply, like, go and sit at a different table, and I will have my books with me. I will say when they invited me over, I'm like, well, you know, unless you have a better story to tell me than Faulkner or, you know, a better way of saying things than Whitman, then I'm not, you know, I prefer to sit with my books and read, and, you know, I'll talk to you later. So they thought of me, you know, not in a very, as being a very nice person because of that, but, you know, I was protecting myself.
And that eventually leads to you having to leave your job because you're worried that they will find out about your status. Can you share what that was like?
Yeah, it was horrible. It was horrible, but it was not unexpected because, you know, I mean...
Is it something you thought about every morning when you got up?
I was just going to say that. I mean, that was something I was fearing since the first moment I got the job. You know, I'm like, they're going to find out that I'm undocumented and they're going to fire me. So... I mean, that's the kind of fragility and the kind of uncertainty that people like me on a daily basis have to go through. You know, that you're never sure about anything, right? That, I mean, you're never sure what's going to happen next minute because there's very little certainty about anything at all.
And so the way that you left... Can you share the way that you found out that you were going to have to resign?
Yeah. I mean, it was actually thanks to some of the policies implemented by Barack Obama. He, instead of, you know, doing raids on different industries, what his administration did was they started doing audits. And it was one of those audits in the place where I worked where, you know, they came up to me saying, you know, you need to clarify this problem with your social security number. And I knew at that time that it was time for me to basically say bye. So I resigned.
When you wrote this book and you shared all of this, and you speak... you speak on campuses all across the country sharing this story. What kind of responses do you get from students when you talk to them about this?
I was not expecting this kind of response from students who many, I imagine, are DACA recipients. But they come to me and they have embraced the book enthusiastically because it speaks to them. It speaks to their experience. But mainly what I hear when I speak on campuses like that is that this is the story of their parents. You know, that's the story that they have heard growing up. They might have gone through, you know, many of them, they might have been brought to the States like that too, but they were too little to remember. But they do tell me that, you know, this is what their parents tell them about the crossing and living alive in the shadows.
And when you wrote this book, it was a different political climate than it is now. I wonder what you think now about the current political climate, the current conversation around immigration, the fact that we had a government shutdown over immigration. I wonder what you think about the way that we're talking about immigration policy now.
I honestly have become very skeptical and cynical about the whole political system. I think it is an entire farce what's going on right now, because, you know, yes, people say we're talking about immigration, but we're not really talking about immigration when you are leaving over 10 million people out of the conversation.
Because they're just talking about DACA students.
Exactly. Well, and not only that, I mean, they're talking about DACA, and they're talking about building a wall. They're talking about ending the visa lottery system, and they're talking about ending what they call chain migration, which is family reunification. I mean, they're not talking about more than 10 million people who are being left out of the conversation. And that's my main problem right now with them. I mean, and it, you know, back in 2008, I mean, I was a little more optimistic, maybe more naive. I think now I'm more realistic, because this is a conversation that I've been hearing. People, I mean, the person sitting in the Oval Office right now, you know, got elected on this very issue, you know.
So I guess my question is, what do you want people to be talking about? Do you want people to understand?
And I would like people to understand that every single person in the U.S. and in Mexico as well, we all benefit from the labor of an undocumented immigrant. You know, all of us, in one way or another, you know, you wake up in the morning, you have breakfast, that piece of fruit that you have, those apples that you eat in the morning, they go through undocumented hands. You know, we pay our taxes, our very fair share of taxes, $10 billion per year. $10 billion would that be? I mean, that's not little. So what I'm trying to say is that people are an integral part of this society, people like myself. And the fact that we're not being talked about is just, you know, that's what seems to me like kind of, I don't know, it seems a little hypocritical.
Well, and to your point about being invisible also, Jose Angel, I just wanted to ask you, this seems like a strange question to ask someone, I think, who's spent more than half of your life here. But, you know, you're married, you're a father, you've spent more than half of your life here. Does this feel like home?
That is a really good question to ask. I think yes and no, both at the same time. But what is home anyway? You know, I mean, you know, I think there's an experience that's particular to all immigrants everywhere in the world. Like, once you leave home, you can never go back. You know, you can never reach home or return home. You're always caught in the middle, you know. I mean, but you have to count your blessings, you know. I mean, there are things that you I mean, there's a reason why we migrate, we go to other places, right? And you have to come to terms with it.
Jose Angel N is the author of Illegal: Reflections of an Undocumented Immigrant. Jose Angel, thank you for sharing your story with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Freezing winter temperatures are nothing new to Illinois residents, but besides being just unpleasant, the cold can also create serious home problems for homeowners. Think about frozen pipes. Just this month in Peoria, the local historical society faced serious damage to one of its historic homes because of frozen pipes. In Monticello, the high school was closed for 2 days after 15 pipes broke in their school. And last month in Aurora, an apartment building caught fire when residents were trying to thaw frozen pipes with a propane heater. To help us figure out what we need to do to prevent a pipe catastrophe, we're joined by Kyle Saunders. He's the water superintendent for the city of Rockford, on the line with us from there now. Hi, Kyle. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Have you had to deal with a lot of cases of frozen pipes this year, Kyle?
You know, the first few weeks into the month of January, we did see a significant increase in the number of frozen pipes on the customer side, where basically we'd sent out an inspector and help them thaw through either you know, a utilizing a hairdryer or just, you know, getting a steady flow of water through a fixture. But yeah, so the past couple weeks, we've seen that with the warmer temps kind of subside, but we have seen an increase this year, yes.
Kyle, can we just start with the basics here? You mentioned a hairdryer. Is that something that you can use to freeze pipes? To unfreeze pipes? Is that a good idea?
Yes, and the reason being is similar to what you mentioned in the opening. You know, using an actual flame is a direct heat source. A hairdryer, you know, we like to kind of refer to it as an indirect heat source, where, you know, whereby it uses the latent heat to help slowly thaw the inside of the pipe that frozen water. Using a direct heat source, you know, oftentimes can result in burst pipes, which obviously cause, you know, much larger issues.
Can I ask you a question? How many days of freezing cold it has to get to before pipes freeze?
You know, it's very variable. You know, depending on how deep the water main, the water service, the public, you know, the private service line is, you know, usually in this area, our pipes are buried 6 feet beneath our feet. Depending on how many constant days of below freezing temperatures we have would dictate how quickly that frost, you know, dives deep into the ground. So when we were seeing those two weeks of, you know, sub 10 degree below zero weather, obviously those frost depths were nearing, 3 to 4 feet, which started to, you know, cause those freezing pipes. But, you know, really more so, it wasn't a frost driven issue. We were seeing that a lot of our customers didn't winterize, meaning that, you know, they didn't insulate any plumbing that doesn't have heating. Some oftentimes left a, you know, window well open, cracked in the fall months, and that, you know, caused the basement to freeze and freeze the pipe. So we saw it to be more of a lack of winterization issue than an actual, you know, frozen pipe because of the frost issue.
Right, and that brings me to the question, this isn't a problem necessarily only with old pipes, correct? Can new houses suffer from this?
Yeah, absolutely. It's any and all pipes are subject to potential freezing. It's really just a function of, you know, how well the pipes are insulated, you know, how well the heat is controlled within a home, and then obviously a function of how quickly that frost does dive deep into the ground. So, yeah, it's kind of all pipes are created equal in terms of their ability to freeze.
So my last question to you is, if we're in late January already, what's your advice for folks? Is it, I imagine, too late to kind of insulate pipes now, right? What should people be thinking about for the rest of the winter?
Well, it's never too late if you do have interior pipes that, you know, aren't insulated already. I mean, you can go to a local hardware store and buy, you know, pipe insulation and slide that over your pipes if they are in the basement and they, you know, you don't have adequate heat. But, you know, one of the simplest recommendations or solutions is, you know, if these temperatures do continue to stay very cold, sub-zero conditions, one thing that our customers can do is, you know, just run a constant flow of water at a fixture that's furthest away from where the service enters the house. That way, you know, moving water, flowing water will not freeze. And it only takes, you know, a pencil lead diameter amount of water, so not very much water. If you keep that constant flow and then open up any cupboards so that the heat can get into those pipes, you know, that's the best way of mitigating frozen pipes short of, you know, insulation and winterization.
That's Kyle Saunders. He's water superintendent for the city of Rockford. Hey, Kyle, thanks for being with me.
No problem. Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to be speaking about a case that's been going on in nearby Michigan, making national news. It's the trial of Dr. Larry Masser, Nassar, the former Olympic gymnast doctor. Stay tuned to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. For the rest of the program, we're going to talk about the case of USA Gymnastics Dr. Larry Nassar. It's an odd and awful juxtaposition to hear the horrific testimonies that have been coming out of the Lansing courtroom during the sexual abuse trial, just as many are preparing for the upcoming Winter Olympics. Here's team captain, two-time Olympian Ellie Raceman, addressing her accuser.
The tables have turned, Larry. We are here. We have our voices, and we are not going anywhere. And now, Larry, it's your turn to listen to me. There is no map that shows you the pathway to healing. Realizing that you are a survivor of sexual abuse is really hard to put into words. Imagine feeling like you have no power and no voice. Well, you know what, Larry? I have both power and voice, and I am only beginning to just use them.
That's CNN footage of Ellie Raceman, an Olympic gold winner, addressing Dr. Larry Nassar. After weeks of heartfelt testimony like that, in which he has been accused of molestation or engaging in misconduct by more than 100 women and girls, some as young as six, yesterday the judge handed down her final sentence, 40 to 175 years in prison. Here's Judge Rosemarie Aquilina.
Sir, I'm giving you 175 years, which is 2,100 months. I've just signed your death warrant.
That audio from NPR is of Judge Rosemarie Aquilina during Dr. Nassar's sentencing yesterday. He'd already been sentenced to 60 years in federal prison for child pornography convictions. The fallout continues for this scandal. On Wednesday, the CEO of the U.S. Olympic Committee announced an independent investigation intended to determine how the sexual abuse went on for as long as it did. And closer to home here in Illinois, there's a question of who knew what at Michigan State University, where Nassar was a professor from 1997 until 2016. On Tuesday, the NCAA formally opened an investigation into MSU. Yesterday evening, President Lou Anna Simon also said she was resigning after having spent her entire career at the university. I'm joined now on the line from Ann Arbor by longtime college sports writer John Ubakin. He teaches about college sports and sports writing at the University of Michigan. He also teaches at Northwestern here in Illinois. John, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you. Thank you, Nialu.
John, what about this resignation yesterday from President Simon? I saw you tweeting about the way in which she resigned. I think we should probably start with that because I imagine it's a bit of an understatement to say you don't think she handled even her resignation very well.
That is very fair. First of all, the public is calling for her resignation well in advance of the actual fact. And on Friday, when they finally met, the trustees, eight of them, in a private closed-door session, which raises other questions, we all expected at that point that they'd be demanding her resignation. Instead, they basically doubled down, all but one, and confirm their support for her and that she's not going anywhere. So that was quite surprising. And finally, of course, the pressure built and built throughout the week, and finally last night, President Simon decided to resign. But in the resignation, as you have been following me, of course, on Twitter, it was at best tone deaf, frankly. And if I may read a few very small bits of this,
sure, go ahead,
for your listeners to give you a sense of what my problems are with this. They are as follows. She starts by saying, "The last year and a half has been very difficult for the victims of Larry Nassar, for the university community, and for me personally." That's really probably not the place to talk about your own suffering.
That's the first thing she said, just to be clear?
First sentence of the resignation. And when I read that, my eyebrows went up, and it did not get better as I kept reading. So she added, "As tragedies are politicized, blame is inevitable. As president, it is only natural that I am the focus of this anger." First of all, I have no idea what she's talking about at all with the tragedies being politicized. I've not seen any left or right, Democratic, Republican, liberal, conservative take on this other than what a tragedy and why wasn't it stopped. So I have no idea what she's talking about there. She's now claiming also that the anger towards her is only because she's in fact the president. But when you hear the athletes speak on this, as you already have, what they're mad about is not that she's the president, is that she did nothing and seemed not to care. And then she, of course, closes by saying, "I will continue to do whatever I can to help MSU in whatever role I may play." And I would say, based on that letter alone, the smaller her role is, the better for everybody. So this was not her shiny moment. It does suggest a tone deafness and a dismissiveness, frankly, that probably led to the problem in the first place.
That's John Bacon, who's on the line with us from Ann Arbor, longtime college sports writer and journalist. I want to bring someone else into this conversation, MSU student journalist Madison O'Connor. She's a sophomore, and she's the campus news editor of MSU's paper, The State News. Madison, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me as well.
Thanks for having me.
Madison, in a recent editorial that you all wrote, you called for President Simon's resignation. You wrote, MSU, your house is on fire. It's been on fire. Slowly, MSU is trying to put the fire out. But once it's out, there will be ugly remnants. Do you feel like even the way the president resigned is in itself kind of another one of these remnants?
Yeah, so we did call for her to resign, and she did end up resigning. And I do think that our editorial did help put some pressure on her to resign. Obviously, there were some other people who also pressured her to resign. But I think that the way she resigned has students a little bit confused. I was on campus this morning, and everyone is still just starting to pay attention now, I think, for the most part. Obviously, there are students who have been paying attention throughout all of this, but the students who don't really know what's going on, I think, are confused by her words and confused by her statement. So I think that definitely starts to show through in the letter that she released.
Madison, I was going to ask you about this, how much people are talking about this on campus. This has been a national news story. I feel like it's been a big part of the national media. Certainly, it's something that I think folks in the Midwest are hearing even more about because we're seeing people in Michigan talk about it, too. Has this been something that's been an all-consuming topic on campus? It sounds like not necessarily.
Yeah, it's been interesting. I've actually covered this story for the past year. And, you know, in the beginning, there was a lot of disbelief on campus. This is a doctor who had an extremely prominent standing, not only within the gymnastics world, but also on our campus. And I think there was a lot of disbelief until December of 2016 when news broke that, you know, he had thousands upon thousands of images of child pornography. But, you know, since that all happened, students have started to pay attention. The steam has really picked up on campus. I don't think it's taken a while for it to really take hold of our campus, though. And maybe that's just me not knowing what students know. But I really do think that now, today, students really want to know what's going on. They want to pay attention. You know, yesterday when Nasser was sentenced in court here in Ingham County in Michigan, you know, all of the students were glued to the TVs, you know, in all of our buildings. And that was something that we noticed. So I think students are really starting to pay attention now.
Madison, what about athletes at the university? What are you hearing from them?
Yeah, I have to say I personally haven't heard a ton from some of the current student athletes, but we've heard a lot from MSU former athletes and people outside of gymnastics too. You know, we've heard from rowers, from soccer players, from people who are not necessarily gymnasts. And there are some Nasser survivors who currently go to the university who have spoken out and who have said, you know, MSU, it's time to make changes. So I think the athletes have been very vocal about wanting to make changes, and particularly former athletes.
Madison, what is your reporting showing? And I wonder how you feel as a student about how the university has handled this.
Yeah, I think over the past year, you know, we've been with this from the very beginning. I remember way back when there were probably 15 or 16 women who made allegations. We were in this newsroom and we were like, oh my gosh, this is crazy. This is insane. And for the number to be at, you know, now almost 200 is crazy. And I think it just goes to show how important journalism is and student journalism too. I mean, this is happening in our own backyard. And, you know, as student journalists and as journalists in general, it's our job to make sure that our institutions are doing what is right, are doing what is fair, are doing what is moral. So I think that our reporting has had, you know, a strong hold here in the community as well. I'm really proud of what we've done so far, and I'm really looking forward to seeing, you know, what else we have in store.
I'm speaking with Madison O'Connor. She's a sophomore at MSU. She's the campus news editor of State News. That's the student newspaper on campus. John Bacon is with us as well, a longtime sports writer and journalist. John, when we're talking about how the university has handled this, I wanted to ask you, the NCAA is also now opening an investigation into this. What does that mean?
That complicates everything, sadly, and that will not make anything easier. I want to say before I even dive into this, though, that I've already retweeted the State News's editorial on this because I thought it was so clear-eyed and so good, what Madison and her colleagues had put out there, and also sent out a tweet last night saying the young journalists at the State News have done outstanding work throughout this process. They really have. And Madison's right. The journalists have done a great job. Many of them in this state, of course, are Michigan State graduates who have done exemplary work. And I would say the university itself, when we use that term, clearly I have issues with President Simon, with some of the executives, with the Board of Trustees. But the student protest, the student paper, the faculty outrage, the alumni in the media, and, of course, women who testified in the courtroom, they have proven themselves to be a gleaming example of what Michigan State should stand for and usually does. So this is clearly an anomaly and a horrible one. And now, of course, you've got the NCAA, because one of those guys I've got a problem with is Joel Ferguson, a 30-year trustee at Michigan State, who had so many unbelievably insensitive comments on Monday dismissing this Nassar thing, saying President Simon on Monday was the best we've ever had, and then saying that the NCAA would never investigate us because they're not competent enough to do so. Well, 24 hours later, the NCAA decided that they were, in fact, competent enough to do so, no doubt taking his challenge, and now you've got them crawling through the campus. And I don't welcome this. I welcome a serious criminal investigation. This is could not be more serious, obviously. But when the NCAA gets involved in things like this, they are greatly in over their head. They have no idea how to handle this stuff. This is an organization that adjudicates on whether or not a student-athlete can put butter or cream cheese on your bagel. I'm not making that up. If you put butter on it, it's a snack. If you put cream cheese on it, it's a meal.
Oh, boy.
And therefore, it's a violation. So these guys are going to handle 100-some women and sexual assault. I don't like that prospect. Furthermore, what they'll end up doing is punishing those who have already been punished, and that is the gymnastic athletes themselves. The coach is already gone. So the NCAA getting involved is nothing but bad news from my point of view, and we more or less proved that with Penn State, I think. So a serious criminal investigation, yes. The NCAA, no. But when you're basically challenged to a knife fight by Trustee Ferguson, they have little choice.
Madison, as there's the NCAA investigation, there's still civil cases against the university. This has prohibited the Board of Trustees and the leadership this is to their mind why they cannot speak about what he did. What do students want here? And as a student journalist on campus, what do you want to hear from the administration?
Yeah, students just want change. Students want to be proud of their university. Students want to be a part of something that is going to take allegations of sexual assault seriously. They want to be a part of an institution that is able to look at situations like this and say, okay, we're going to do the right thing. As student journalists here at the State News, that's what we want too. You know, we are the voice of, you know, Michigan State University. And if that's what students want, if that's what faculty want, then that's what we want. We really just want the university to try to make things right.
John, one quick question for you. We just have less than a minute left, but you write about sports at a number of colleges, not just in Michigan. Do you think what happened here is rare? Is this now that we've had Penn State, now we have Michigan State? Would you be surprised to learn about this happening at any major university with a large athletics program?
To the degree that it has happened, I am shocked. More than 100 women for 20 years. That's sad and tragic, to say the least. No doubt there are pedophiles, there are predators in every college campus, and I'm sure none of them are excluded from that. The question is, how far can you get before you get caught? And let's hope that in most places we have better controls in place to stop such people when the first signs arise. So I doubt we're seeing the last of this. I suspect we're seeing perhaps the last of this magnitude, and let's hope that I'm right, because all we can do from our point of view is hope beyond an act of change that Madison is talking about. You'd never guess it at Penn State, and you'd never guess it at Michigan State, so here we are.
That's John Bacon, a longtime college sports writer. He's also the author of a number of other books, not necessarily about sports, his latest being The Great Halifax Explosion, a World War I story of treachery, tragedy, and extraordinary heroism. John, thank you to you. Madison O'Connor, thanks for being with us. Thank you for all the work that you have done and the State News has done as student journalists at MSU's campus. Good job by you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That does it for us today. You can always head to our website, 21stshow.org, to find past shows or information on how to contact us. We are a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.